I enjoy short stories because it's a nice, juicy literary nugget that you can bite into and consume quickly.
From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. The annual Ohio Anna Book Festival celebrates Ohio authors. We talked to a number of authors at the 2009 festival about their latest publications and the writing life. In this episode, we talked to Charlize Lyles.
Hello, welcome back to the CSW podcast. I'm talking with Charlize Lyles, who is the author of Do I Dare Disturb the Universe? And she's going to talk to us about this book and the topics that she's working on in her writing process and other things. So welcome, Charlize.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Tell me about Do I Dare Disturb the Universe? It sounds reminiscent of the line, Do I Dare Eat a Peach Out of the Wasteland? Is it based on that or something else?
Very close, very close. The title is taken from the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot.
Right.
And Do I Dare Eat a Peach is actually a line from the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
Right.
And so is Do I Dare Disturb the Universe.
Okay. Probably comes next after he can't decide whether he eats the peach or not.
Right.
I always remember the peach line for some reason.
Right. And often people find the title ironic because, of course, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock is about a British gentleman going to tea and feeling very awkward and uncomfortable. And my story, the subtitle of my book, is From the Projects to Prep School. Mm-hmm. And as I migrated from the projects in Cleveland, the King Kennedy Estates, up the hill, or the Magic Mountain, as I call it, to Hawken School, a very elite private preparatory school, I too felt like J. Alfred Prufrock, like a fish out of water, very uncomfortable, very uneasy, not very confident about what was ahead. So that's why I chose this title, Do I Dare Disturb the Universe? I was always fearful in my new environment at prep school that I would say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, or here I come with my Angela Davis afro and my bell-bottom two-tone pants and not quite fitting in with the corduroys and Docksiders and earth shoes and trying to find my place and trying to find a comfort level, just as T.S. Eliot's Prufrock was trying to find a comfort level with those very prim ladies at tea.
Okay. So this traces your life from, it looks like, maybe age 10, 12, to what point?
To graduation from high school.
Okay.
To 18 years old.
Okay. And I don't want to give away the story, but what... There's an arc there that takes you from the projects, as you said, to prep school. And what's then happened after that? What did you, what's in the next book, I guess, is the take on.
My next book? You know, someone recommended that I write another memoir about what happens from graduation onward. And at first I thought it was kind of a ridiculous idea because I've never really thought of myself as a memoirist in the tradition of Maya Angelou, who has written several memoirs building on I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, her first book. But after I pondered that idea, I thought maybe there is another memoir in me, because my family's history has unfolded, and you know, all the family secrets have begun to seep out at this point. And I'm thinking maybe there is another story or two in here. So I don't know what it would be titled, but it's certainly something that I am considering more seriously than I did 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, what other projects are you working on? If you're not a memoirist, you must be working on another genre then.
Right. I enjoy attempting to write short stories. And so I love the art of the short story because it's a nice, juicy literary nugget that you can bite into and consume quickly and feel like you have read something. And so what I'm working on right now is a novel called, it's had several working titles, Mama, I Wrote a Rap for You. And it is in the tradition of the Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver. Several different people telling their version of a single event. And so several different voices. over a different time. And basically, it's about the birth of a biracial child in 1960s Southern Virginia, and how a small community reacted to that, and how the child grew up and eventually came back. So that's what I'm working on. And I'm also working on a nonfiction project with the dean of the Martin Luther King Chapel at Morehouse College on the peace practices of Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Daisaku Ikeda, who is a lesser known, but of equal stature, really, Buddhist peace activist. Okay. So those are my two projects of the moment.
So you've got these two projects going. Do they have really different writing processes? Do you have to be in very different headspaces to work on them? And how do you achieve that?
Mm-hmm. Great question. They do require two very different heads. Mm-hmm. One is very much the Gandhi King Ikeda project is very much a research project, but mm-hmm. but very deep in terms of really understanding and appreciating these three men and the lives they've lived and their fight for social justice. So that's very much research driven and very formatted. There's a very clear structure designed sort of after what I call internet writing. You know, we use a quote here, and then we have a summary of this point, and then we have an excerpt or scene from the life mm-hmm. of one of each man, and then there's a very specific point that we're trying to illuminate, their use of dialogue in peace activism, their belief in the respect for all human life.
What led you to that structure? I mean, it sounds like it's so rigid. How did it get imposed? Is it your choice?
It is in my choice. Largely because the material is so overwhelming.
Right.
There's so much that has been written about Gandhi, so much about King, mm-hmm. and a considerable amount about Ikeda. And what we wanted to do was, first of all, make these parallels between mm-hmm. the three lives
right.
and their peace practices, if you will. And so we needed to compress and condense so that the parallels mm-hmm. are clear, and that the material didn't just sort of overwhelm. So that's why we have that very clear, rigid structure. It actually imposes a discipline on the process. And I, as a writer, I need discipline. I mm-hmm. need to have structure imposed on me. Writing a memoir is probably, I won't say easier, but the story flows and it can continue to flow and flow and flow until
right.
you get a good editor in there to do the Edward Scissorhands.
I've never heard an editor referred to as Edward Scissorhands. I think that, though, there are many writers who would appreciate that idea.
Right.
Makes you into topiary, though. I mean,
right. In contrast, which can be beautiful, topiary.
Yep.
In contrast, the novel does allow for a little more of that flow and then coming back to edit artfully. Mm-hmm. Because what I love about writing the novel is that I find there are many voices inside of me, mm-hmm. many characters from a white Baptist minister to an old African-American woman who is sort of the griot or wise mother of mm-hmm. a small community. In between is a Vietnam veteran, a young black woman who is unable to bear children, and the mother of the biracial child who is torn. Finds herself torn between keeping the child and letting the child mm-hmm. go because of the time in which it's born. It's not accepted. And then as well as the voice of her husband. So I find all of these people live in me mm-hmm. and they have very strong lives and the writing can go on. And so I have to, again, impose discipline on myself to craft the story and not just let it sort of go on in this undisciplined monologue.
You know, I've often wondered when I come upon books with some really distinct characters like you're talking about, when you're writing it, do you hear it in the head? Do you hear the accent in the head? Do you ever speak the dialogue out loud in the accent? I'm just curious, how much of it is performative for you mm-hmm. When you're doing this kind of stuff? Because I can imagine myself, I'm not a fiction writer, much of a writer at all anymore. But I do these things, especially when no one else is in the car, where you're like your Monty Python accent or something silly. Is this something that's part of yours, or is it just all, are you serious at the keyboard and you don't have that sort of play?
Well, it's serious, but it's serious play. Mm-hmm. I think that's the best way to answer. Okay. The operative word there is performative. I really do hear and speak the voice of the white Baptist minister, mm-hmm. and not in a mocking way, mm-hmm. but in a very, very real way. That person lives in me. I don't know where it came from. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of possession, I guess. But it's very real. But there is that performative aspect to it, mm-hmm. because I can, his words come to me. It's sort of mystic part of writing, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I find myself speaking them at the typewriter, bringing that voice, that character to life, as well as the old African-American woman who's sort of the wise mother. Mm-hmm. She's there. The Vietnam veteran is there. And I do find myself, as you described, I was laughing as you said that, in the car, you know, some line will come to me, and that line will lead into a whole strand of plot. Mm-hmm. Just a single line. So the characters really come through the language. The language yields to plot and character actions. As opposed to character action sort of leading to the language. It works through the language for me. Yeah. That illuminates.
You always hear, or at least I'm accustomed to hearing people ask, are you plot-driven? Are you character-driven? And I think it's much, I think if I were to do writing, I'd be more dialogue-driven, where it occurs to me someone would say this or that. I had a fiction teacher in college who was fond of going out and with a friend, and they would make up dialogue for two people that they saw, like, at the other table. And, you know, which, you know, as long as you don't get caught at it, is great fun. But it always, you know, that one stuck with me as, you know, somebody else maybe who's driven by the dialogue of it, who mm-hmm. says, you know, it's, but maybe that's just character driven and I'm not taking it. But
well, I think in my memoir, Do I Dare Disturb the Universe, there is a lot of good dialogue, mm-hmm. recreated, reconstructed. But I think I have a good hand for it, a good ear for it. Mm-hmm. And I would say that my novel, at times I refer to it as a novel of voices. I can almost see it as a series of monologues performed mm-hmm. on a stage. And it's actually, I'm exploring a hybrid between the traditional novel, the traditional short story, and theater. I love mm-hmm. theater. I haven't been able to perform in many years because I have to work to pay the rent, you know. Mm-hmm. But I hope before I depart this planet that I'm able to do something on the stage again. I would love to stage a novel, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, it sounds a lot like Winesburg, Ohio, you know, where they have all those characters coming in to talk, and then they're intertwined, but it's just those vignettes, like mm-hmm. you say, a theatrical sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What genre of writing haven't you written that you'd like to try your hand at?
I have been a journalist for 20-something years, mm-hmm. so I've written journalistically as a news reporter, mm-hmm. as a commentator or columnist. I've done memoir and creative nonfiction. I've written fiction, though not yet been published as a fiction author. I've written poetry, actually, won some prizes back in the day. Mm-hmm. So what genre have
What kind of fiction was it? I mean, there's so many kinds of fiction.
Well, fiction by fiction, I'm referring to the novel I was describing,
right,
but
right.
it's not yet published.
But I mean, there's, you know, like one of the things, you know, you take somebody who's written a memoir that, you know, is more serious, and you think, all right, what about sci-fi? What about romance? What mm-hmm. about horror fiction? R.L. Stine is here. Is there a horror fiction? Is something going to come out that you didn't expect, you know, under the bed?
I don't know. That would be exciting. I'm always open to the discovery, truly. Mm-hmm. But I haven't birthed an idea yet for science fiction. Perhaps fantasy. Mm-hmm. That sort of interests me. And here's a crazy idea I had. I love Charles Dickens and Victor Hugo. And at some point, I'd like to take Charles Dickens's approach to characters and apply it in a contemporary context to a story in perhaps an urban setting, you know, in which some of the characters would be sort of emblematic of different ideas, mm-hmm. you know, like for example, in Bleak House, you have the character who represents deportment. He's all about style and demeanor and presenting oneself. And I'd like to explore something like that. I guess the best answer I have for that is my mind tends toward more experimental ideas, as I said earlier, a hybrid of short story, novel, and theater. Mm-hmm. That idea, as well as this Dickensian kind of idea mm-hmm. of character.
Okay. Well, while we're on the topic of people like Dickens, tell me what your funniest or best anecdote you've heard or experienced about writers. What's the favorite one you like to exchange with other writers?
Oh, I'm not sure I have one. All I can say is that when I tell others who are not writers that writing for me is a subtle form of torture that I enjoy, they don't quite seem to get what I'm talking about. But when I say that to other writers, they get it, mm-hmm. you know, right away. But I don't really know much writer's humor.
So you're suggesting that that all writers are masochists of some form. Is that it?
Yes. I mean, there's joy when you get deep into the work. Mm-hmm. But for me, getting started is sometimes very hard. Once I get going and I can sustain it without the disruptions of earning a living and all of those challenges day-to-day life, there's great joy. But getting started and sustaining it is torturous for me. It's really hard, really hard. And the deep joy comes in that in-between space. Mm-hmm. You know.
So when were you sure that you were going to be a writer, if it's torturous for you? What age did you decide that this torment was your future?
Oh, I think I decided in my 10th grade poetry class at Hawkins School with Peter Scott. He was my teacher, and he taught all of the great poets, from Shakespeare to Langston Hughes to Robert Frost to Sylvia Plath. All of them, all of the great ghosts. And we learned rhyme and meter and how to scan poetry. And I really learned to appreciate the technical aspects of poetry and writing. Mm-hmm. And I think around that time, I started to really, I'd kept a journal since about 9th grade mm-hmm. and just enjoyed writing my thoughts. But then I started to sort of write my thoughts in poetry and really enjoy it and share some of my little scrappings with others, my nuggets with others. But I think it was around that time that I decided that I would have to do something with language and the word, you know.
Okay. And the final question, what authors are on your nightstand right now? What books are on your nightstand?
Les Miserables by Victor Hugo. Mm-hmm. And I was prompted to start reading it again, because as you know, it is a very long novel.
Right. You have to want to know a lot about the sewer systems of Paris right. to read this book. Like Moby Dick teaches you about more about whaling
right.
than you ever wanted to know.
Right, right. My book club had just finished reading a book called The Ghost Wall about the cholera outbreak in England in, I think, 1859. And so that prompted my interest. And then that woman who was on Great Britain's Got Talent, Susan Boyle, she mm-hmm. sang the song from the musical, I Dreamed a Dream.
Oh, right.
And so beautifully that it just, I had been meaning to read it. I had started it before, but now I'm determined to get through it. So that's on the stand. The Lost Painting of Caravaggio is on my stand. It's by a professor of creative writing at Smith College. It's nonfiction. Aunt Hagar's Children by Edward Jones, who he's a MacArthur Fellow and a Pulitzer Prize winner. And I have some writings on Buddhism. I study Buddhism, practice Buddhism.
Every writer I've talked to has this enormous nightstand.
Yeah, I do. And my husband kind of looks over there like, I keep mine clean. How come you don't keep yours mm-hmm. clean?
I bet there's a fortune to be made in advertising library nightstands in literary magazines.
Right.
Where you can keep all of that stuff, you know, down there where your spouse or partner doesn't have to look at it.
Right. So that's what's on my nightstand. And the book Sound and Sense, it's just a compilation of poetry. And I had that book from 10th grade English, the class that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. I keep it with me because it's just quick access to different poems. You know, I know a page the road less traveled is on in there.
Right.
And quick lessons on poetry. So I keep that either on the nightstand or on my desk, someplace around the house I can mm-hmm. get to it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's about it.
Well, I thank you very much for stopping to talk to us. Do you have a website that you'd like to direct people to?
Well, I have a blog. I don't have the address. If you Google my name, Charlize Lyles, or Do I Dare Disturb the Universe from Projects to Prep School, you'll get my blog. And I wish that you would comment on it because not many people have.
Mm-hmm. Be sure to check out our other Ohioana podcasts and our many author interviews at www.writerstalk.org. Until next time, keep writing.